This is ExpertHR.com, your go-to HR compliance resource for federal, state, and municipal law. I'm David Weisenfeld for ExpertHR.com, published by Reed Business Information and proudly partnered with LexisNexis. On this podcast, a look at the latest employment news out of California and how it's likely to affect the workplace in 2016. It's no secret California has been at the forefront when it comes to breaking new ground in the employment law realm. And this past year certainly did nothing to diminish that reputation, as a number of new laws were enacted. At the head of the list are significant changes to the Golden State's Equal Pay Statute, which have led Governor Jerry Brown to call it the strongest equal pay law in the nation. We'll examine that notable new development and others with Anthony Onsidi, who heads the Labor and Employment Law Group in the Los Angeles office of Proskauer Rose. Tony represents employers and management in all aspects of employment law, and he speaks frequently on a wide range of employment issues. Tony, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you. My pleasure to be back, David.
Well, let's start with the equal pay law that I just mentioned. Effective January 1st, male and female employees who perform substantially similar work in California must receive equal pay even if they have different job titles. What stands out to you the most about this law?
The most, I think, important aspect of this is that it adjusts the circumstances under which a claim can be brought by obviously liberalizing them. Previously, there was on the books a gender wage discrimination law already, Section 1197.5 of the Labor Code. But what that did is it made it illegal to have the same establishment pay men and women differently for equal work. What this amendment does is this extends that prohibition to different rates of pay for, quote, substantially similar work. So rather than just equal work, substantially similar work now is the concept that has been injected into the statute. And that, of course, will be, I think, the battlefield for both employees and employers in terms of whether something is a substantially similar type of work for which the same rate of pay must be paid. There also is another major change in that it similarly used to apply to the same establishment. Now it can be beyond the same establishment, so you can have challenges based on that as well.
And from an HR perspective, this law really seems to place the burden on employers to demonstrate exemptions. So what do you see that meaning as a practical matter?
Well, the exemptions are, again, a lot of these are kind of buzzwords that I think have yet to be tested, obviously, because the law hasn't taken effect yet. But one of them, for example, is that the employer must affirmatively demonstrate that a wage differential is based on a seniority system, a merit system, quantity or quality of production, or any bona fide factor other than sex. So the burden is shifted to the employer to show those things. Each factor that is relied upon must be applied reasonably, and that these factors account for the entire wage differential. In other words, you can't just say, well, it's in part explainable by some or all of those criteria. Now you have to be able to say that those factors account for the entire wage differential. As you can imagine, the devil will be in the details once these cases start getting litigated.
Absolutely. One provision I wanted to ask you about, Tony, in this law allows an employee to ask about or freely discuss a coworker's pay without fear of retaliation from their employer. So that really begs the question of what happens if someone, say, goes on Facebook and asks people to, say, email their salary information. Can an employer stop that legally?
I think it's going to be very, very difficult. There already was a provision of the California Labor Code on the books that prohibited retaliation against employees who discussed these kinds of issues. There's also a federal provision of the National Labor Relations Act that prohibits retaliation against employees who discuss terms and conditions, including wages and bonuses and so on. What this does do is it strengthens, however, the hand of employees who are having those kinds of discussions, whether it be in the workplace or whether it be on social media, which increasingly, of course, is, as they say, the water cooler of the modern era.
Indeed, and certainly the NLRB has been getting increasingly interested in that area. Tony, another lawyer that I spoke with said that this law, in his view, absolutely is going to lead to more litigation for employers. Do you see it that way?
I do. I think the provisions make it easier for employees to assert claims, but probably more importantly is that when these kinds of laws get passed, it shakes things up. It reminds employees, and maybe even more importantly, employment lawyers on the plaintiff side, that there are additional weapons that they can be using in these kinds of litigated matters. And as a result of that, a renewed attention that is brought to the area, I think, tends to spur claims that might not otherwise have been brought when you've got, as I say, a law that's already been on the books and was pretty fearsome already in terms of what an employer had to do to beat such a case. I've defended many of those cases already under the old law. I think the new law will make it even more difficult for employers to get out of these cases in the event that there is some liability, obviously.
Well, shifting gears, many southern states have passed strict laws mandating the use of the federal E-Verify system to confirm an employee's work eligibility. But California has gone the other way and restricted E-Verify use by employers. What did your state have to say this year, Tony, when it comes to E-Verify?
California is very hostile to any discriminatory acts taken against quote-unquote immigrants, whether they be legal or illegal, or documented or undocumented, depending on how you refer to them. And I know there's just that reference alone is packed with all kinds of meaning. What this new law does, this is AB 622, it makes it an unlawful employment practice, which is a defined term, if an employer uses the E-Verify system at a time or in a manner that's not required by a specific federal law or memorandum of understanding that comes from the federal government. So in essence, what it says is that before an employer just accesses this information online, which is where it is available, you as an employer must be very, very well aware of the circumstances as dictated by federal law that either permit or require such a check. And in the event that the information is checked without authorization under federal law, that is now a potential violation of California state law, and there's a $10,000 penalty for each one of those violations.
Again, we're speaking with Tony Onsidi of Proskauer Rose in Los Angeles. Tony, there were also developments this year in California involving arbitration. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, this is an ongoing battle of the bands, if you will, between the U.S. Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court and other courts in California. The general view of the U.S. Supreme Court, which of course is the supreme decider of many of these kinds of issues, is that the Federal Arbitration Act, the FAA, essentially occupies the field, preempts almost all law on the subject of the enforceability of arbitration provisions, and it is a very pro-arbitration statute and has been so interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court on countless occasions. The California Supreme Court, on the other hand, has a place in its heart for arbitration agreements, which is different from that of the U.S. Supreme Court, and so California has encrusted onto the law of contracts in the state of California all kinds of bells and whistles and requirements that an arbitration agreement must have in order to pass muster under state law. And each and every time that kind of question has gotten to the U.S. Supreme Court, it has struck down this additional set of bells and whistles that have been placed on the requirements and said, no, we really mean it when we say the FAA preempts and you can't have special requirements for arbitration. Where it has come up most recently and most frequently is the provision that many employers now are putting in arbitration agreements, which is a class action waiver requirement, which we certainly advise all of our clients to do if they do have an arbitration regime in place. The Supreme Court, in the case called Concepcion several years ago, said those are perfectly enforceable, and so it really would be foolish for an employer that has an arbitration provision not to also have a class action waiver. The recent fight in California now is, the most recent filigree on all of this is, well, what about Private Attorney General Act claims, which is a special statute we have here in California? Can those also be subject to waiver as part of an arbitration agreement? And the courts in California have said including the Supreme Court, know you can't have a waiver of a private Attorney General Act claim. The U.S. Supreme Court has not yet weighed in on that, and everybody is watching with bated breath here as to when it will. But it really does have the effect of looking a lot like whack-a-mole every time the U.S. Supreme Court has a ruling on this subject, which has all really been quite consistent. The California Supreme Court comes up with another reason not to follow it.
So if I'm a multi-state employer and maybe I just have a couple of employees in California, but I'm based elsewhere, you know, what am I to do? Should I still feel comfortable having these arbitration clauses in light of this law you just mentioned?
I believe so, because number one, the U.S. Supreme Court has not finally decided not to decide the issue from California on the Private Attorney General Act claims. There is a case from the Ninth Circuit which is percolating through the system, and many people believe the U.S. Supreme Court may grant cert on. I don't believe it has yet ruled on a petition in that case. The Ninth Circuit, as we all know, is the court the U.S. Supreme Court loves to hate the most. So they actually upheld the exception for Private Attorney General Act provisions, saying that they are not subject to waiver. We are hopeful that the U.S. Supreme Court, in the latest version of this whack-a-mole game, accepts that Ninth Circuit case for a review and finally does make a decision on that last remaining aspect of California law that is out of compliance. In terms of multi-state entities, I think that they should apply the same rules in California as they do everywhere else, or at least build those into the agreements with the hope, A, that they will be enforceable someday. As far as I know, there is no downside or negative repercussions that may come even if they're found to be unenforceable in California.
And speaking of arbitration, sometimes the biggest news is what doesn't happen, and that may have been the case this year as Governor Jerry Brown vetoed a potentially groundbreaking measure involving the use of mandatory arbitration agreements as a condition of employment. Had he signed that legislation, it would have made the Golden State the only one in the nation with that prohibition. Tony, I know you have some thoughts on that veto, so go right ahead.
It has become the case in recent years that Jerry Brown, although never the most ardent defender of employers or corporate interests, really has been the only ally that those entities have in Sacramento that can be identified, because the California legislature is so vehemently anti-business and anti-employer, and of course that's just my own personal opinion, but certainly the way they act would suggest that. They do each and every term pass probably 2 to 3 times the number of bills that would do violence to employers in California, and Governor Brown has been a fairly good arbiter in terms of, you know, what's good for business in the state of California. He doesn't sign them all, and I would say probably signs fewer than a third of them, but it does give you some indication of what could happen if he weren't there vetoing some of the stuff, including the law you just mentioned, which I am certain would have been struck down by the Supreme Court, but that would have been probably years from now and hundreds of thousands of employees affected or not, one way or the other, and millions and millions and millions of dollars spent.
Tony, are there any other California laws that HR folks should really be on the lookout for that are taking effect in 2016 affecting the workplace?
Yeah, I'll do a quick sort of lightning round on a couple of other things that I think are important. There is a new provision under California law that prohibits retaliation against family members of whistleblowers. This actually is in line with a U.S. Supreme Court case that came down a few years ago in which retaliation was visited upon a fiancé of a whistleblower, and the U.S. Supreme Court decided that that was actually an actionable claim, that that would obviously have a chilling effect. That kind of concept now has been enacted expressly, and it is now part of California labor code. There is also a new ruling that I think is probably going to be interesting once the California Supreme Court decides it, and that has to do with trade secrets. There's a case that's been percolating through the system for a few years here where an employer sued some former employees for misappropriation of trade secrets under the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. So this is not just a California issue. The Uniform Trade Secrets Act is uniform and exists in many states. The employees won in the case because the former employer had no evidence that they had actually misappropriated trade secrets, and those employees were successful not only in winning their case, but in getting $1.6 million in attorney's fees back against their former employer who had sued them in bad faith without any real evidence of misappropriation. The next thing they did, which was a little bit of a surprise, was they then sued their former employer's lawyers for malicious prosecution. And that is the second piece of this, the other shoe falling. as to whether or not the actual lawyers of the former employer can be sued for malicious prosecution, and the California Supreme Court has accepted that case for review. So we're going to have to see whether or not the California Supreme Court disagrees and that the lawyers might also be on the hook for malicious prosecution. So I think that the message here from both employers and their counsel is that if you're going to sue a former employee for misappropriation of trade secrets, you better be darn sure you've got some good evidence that they've actually misappropriated. It is not a riskless act to either threaten or certainly sue former employees for misappropriation in the absence of evidence.
So it's definitely not an area where you just want to throw something against the wall.
No, and it's a surprising, I mean, I'm on both sides of these cases, and when I'm defending these cases, I can tell you a lot of employers' counsel really haven't gotten the memo yet, and they still do threaten and oftentimes actually file lawsuits asserting misappropriation when we know, in fact, that there is no evidence of misappropriation.
In our final minute, I'm going to ask you to put on your crystal ball prognostication hat, and as we look ahead, maybe just give everybody a sense of anything that perhaps has not yet passed, but that you think could come about in California in the near future, either at the state or federal level.
Well, one thing that we didn't discuss, but I think is a big issue, is minimum wage hikes. There really is an arms race going on out here in California, not only at the state level, where the minimum wage is increasing and is marching between $10 and $15, but also at the local levels. Many municipalities are in on this arms race and are beginning to raise the minimum wage, and it is having significant implications for employers all over the state. The minimum wage not too long ago was around $7 an hour, and now it is over 10 and is quickly moving toward 15. So I think that there's going to be a lot of activity with respect to that. I think there might even be some ballot measures in the fall of 2016 on some of these issues, and employers are grappling with that both from an economic standpoint and also a legal standpoint, because when you raise the minimum wage, it also has implications for exemptions and when they apply and when they don't apply. I think that we'll just see more of the same increasing types of leaves of absence. We didn't talk about those, but there's a bunch of new laws on that in California as well. Employees who are now protected once they have taken a leave of absence associated with a family member or with some other issue that might have come up in their lives, all of which individually sound good. The problem often becomes, however, that an employee may be on a list who's scheduled to be laid off in the near future or to be terminated for poor performance or misconduct. And then once they've accessed a leave of absence, then they find themselves in a protected category. And that then complicates things immeasurably for employers. So employers need to be aware of that, just like they do when they're looking at a list of potential terminations in terms of age, race, disabilities. Always add to that list also people who have asked for or taken a leave of absence protected by statute.
All right. Well, Tony, any final thoughts before we let you go?
I think that's it for now, but let's check in a week or two from now. It'll be different.
Okay. That sounds great. Well, Tony Onsidi heads the Labor and Employment Law Practice Group at Proskauer Rose's Los Angeles office, and he's been our special guest. Tony, thanks so much for your insights. I'm sure there'll be a lot more to watch going forward.
Thank you.
I'm David Weisenfeld. We hope you've enjoyed this ExpertHR.com podcast. Thanks again for listening. Continue checking our website regularly for more podcasts on key employment topics affecting the world of HR, including, is your performance appraisal process ready for prime time? The opinions expressed in this program do not represent legal advice, nor should they necessarily be taken as the views of Expert HR or its employees. ExpertHR.com is published by Reed Business Information and is proudly partnered with LexisNexis. For more information about Expert HR, our subscription offering, or our new 50-state employee handbook, call us toll-free at 1-855-973-7847. Again, that's 1-855-973-7847. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved.